Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business. This is the podcast we do here at risky.biz, which is mostly targeted towards government and policy people. My name, of course, is Patrick Gray, and I'll be chatting with Tom Uren in just a moment about all of the stuff, all of the reporting he's done this week on the cyber government beat. But first off, of course, I would like to say thank you to the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative and our founding corporate sponsor, Proofpoint, for making this podcast possible. And Tom, welcome for starters. And there has been barrel loads of ink spilled on the Optus breach here in Australia. You've written it up as Australia's Equifax moment, which I thought was an interesting way to do it. But instead of recapping the breach completely, I thought I'd just give a quick indication as to what's actually happened. But instead of just recapping the breach and talking about all of that, I'd really want to zero in on what you've written about the Australian government's response to this, because this is the part that's relevant to our global audience. But yes, for those of you who haven't heard, Australia's second largest telco, from the looks of things, exposed an unauthenticated API from which an attacker was able to enumerate the personal identifiable information of something like 10 million Australians, including things like passport numbers, date of birth, you know, driver's license numbers, that sort of thing. But the government response here has actually been kind of interesting in that it's mostly been the right one, which we're not quite used to seeing from governments. Tom, would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a new government. There's a new minister. They've created the Minister for Cybersecurity role that was, I guess, disbanded under the previous government. And they're keen to do something practical that will work. So the thing that stood out to me, first of all, and that came out very early, was that they suggested being able to pass the breach data from Optus to the banks. So in this case, the risk is identity theft used to, you know, create a credit card and then conduct fraud by that. So by telling the banks, you immediately let them know, you know, who are the customers that this could happen for, therefore impose extra risk mitigations, you know, extra checks.
Because ultimately, you know, the banks are the ones who are best positioned to actually mitigate this, right? It's not the end users themselves. It is going to be the financial institutions and anyone issuing credit, really.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's, in a weird way, one of the reasons why this kind of breach has an emotional impact, because as a victim, you feel like there's nothing you can do. And that's really because there's very little you can do. Like, if someone else has those details, they can apply for credit and maybe they could get it. Who knows? And so, yeah, by putting that information in the hand of the banks, I think that's a very practical idea. So that requires some change in legislation, but that seems like that's one thing that should happen. People I think I speak to say, yeah, that's a good idea. They've also kind of signaled a whole lot of other things. One thing that they've already got Optus to do is agree to pay for people to get new licenses, and they're pressuring that Optus pay for new passports for people.
This is the part, I'm sorry to cut you off there, but this is the part that I feel like might be venturing into silly politics, if I'm going to be honest, because, you know, as we're going to discuss, like there's a solid chance that the attacker who obtained this data has actually deleted it, okay? Because as part of the response by the Australian government into this thing, they spun up an Australian Federal Police investigation called Operation Hurricane. They were cooperating with the FBI and the Australian Signals Directorate, and they were applying a lot of heat to this attacker who doesn't seem like they're some sort of organized criminal. Like, it seems like a kid doing some opportunistic thing, right? Probably doesn't have great OPSEC. This kid, presumed kid, has had a massive change of heart about selling this data, has deleted the sample sets they published to the breach forums, and issued a groveling apology saying that this data will never see the light of day. I swear, I promise, I'm very, very sorry. So to then replace, you know, 10 million licenses and passports, and for the Prime Minister himself to be standing in Parliament sort of thumping the table about this honestly, to me, this just feels like a political response to the heat the government was getting from the opposition in the early days of this breach being reported on. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just seems, I don't know what's going to be achieved here, really. It just seems like politics.
Yeah, yeah. So I have some sympathy with that view. But also, having said that, I think that there is an emotional impact here. And the words that the foreign minister used were very careful. They said, for people who are concerned about it and feel the need to get new passports. So I think that recognises that for some people, it is, rightly or wrongly, quite traumatic. And I think if they feel the need to get a new passport, why should they have to pay
but,
for
but
it?
But this is my point. We're talking about assuaging people's feelings for a political impact, right? It has nothing really to do with mitigating this breach at scale. So this is the part of the government's response that makes me roll my eyes pretty hard.
Like I said, I've got some sympathy for that, but also, what's the government for except for to make people feel good about their lives? Like, I'm not saying that we mollycoddle everyone.
Well, I think it's to actually, you know, do the practical side, Tom, to actually, you know, make sure that people aren't going to suffer from this breach, and it's less about just making them feel good. But, you know, hey, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, and I think there's a way you can have your cake and eat it, right? And I think the way is to, you know, get that as a deal, but then just not publicise it, not encourage it.
So the 5,000 ultra privacy, privacy nut weirdos who want to get their licences replaced, you know, can do that.
Require a whole lot of paperwork. The people who feel like the need to do that, I think that actually probably is a benefit for them. The people who can't be bothered, well, they're probably okay too in that case.
Because there's one thing that you actually point out in this story is, you know, for something like an online credit card application, you can supply your driver's license number and, you know, a bunch of stuff like that. And then the bank will go and verify that those details are correct with the, you know, document verification services provided by, I think, by the state governments, right? One thing you note in your story is that most of the states, barring Queensland and Victoria, actually allow these institutions to verify the card number on a driver's license as well as the actual license number, which means that the license number, which is leaked through this Optus thing, isn't really much use on its own unless you live in Victoria or Queensland. But they also plan to do card number verification next year anyway, before this even happened. So to me, this strikes me as like an equivalent to a CVV value off a credit card, but for driver's licenses. And I do wonder, though, if we have laws that prohibit the storage of the card numbers, because this is where there's an opportunity for governments to think a little bit more strategically about how to mitigate the impacts of these sorts of breaches. Like, you know, banning the storage of the actual card number seems like it would probably go a long way here to preventing something like this from having an impact in the future.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. And I wasn't aware that there was even such a thing as a card number. So it turns out that only started to be used at the beginning of this month of September. And it seems amazingly foresighted to set up that system, which I think took a number of years. And it just so happens that the breach where it becomes really relevant happens the very month it takes place. So
yeah, it was literally September 1 when they switched over. But the card numbers themselves have been on the licenses for a long time. It's just haven't been verifiable. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's why it took so long. You've got to get the numbers on the cards before you can start implementing it. So to me, that indicates that people have thought about this for a while and are taking steps.
But I think there's an opportunity here, right, for the government to actually sit down, look at the types of information and identifiers that are used to do, identity verification for credit purposes. And in Australia, this is already pretty heavily regulated through the Financial Reporting Act, right, which is the one that says you need to keep AML records and whatever for transactions over $10,000. I remember, you know, once buying a motorcycle for like $10,500 from a dealer years ago. And oh my God, I had to bring so much paperwork with me, even though I was paying cash, right? So this stuff is pretty heavily regulated. But perhaps it's time for the government to sit down and actually issue some very clear guidance on what organisations can and can't store.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think what has happened is the 100 points arose specifically in legislation for a particular purpose, which was anti-financial crime fraud.
We should just mention that what Tom's referring to there is our 100 points of ID system, where a license is 50, your Medicare card is 25, a credit card is this. But yes, it was certainly an anti-money laundering thing when it emerged.
Yeah, and then that's I guess various sectors have thought, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. So it's very, very common to have to produce 100 points of ID to prove who you are. But the weighting systems and what they accept varies across sectors. And I think, yeah, I think what you've suggested is very sensible, that it be regulated exactly what you can store, because you may need those points to prove it beyond a doubt, but you don't need to store those points forever.
Now, another thing the government has flagged is introducing a fine regime for data breach scenarios. I think this is something that sounds really good, but when it comes time to implementing it, it usually gets quite hard, because what if, okay, in this case, it looks like Optus was pretty lax. Their controls were borderline negligent. Okay, so fair enough, right? You know, you might want to throw them a fine. But what happens when another breach happens and it is a really sophisticated actor, when no reasonable blue team could have really been expected to catch it? You know, are you still going to fine the organization that is ultimately the victim of the breach? This is where it starts getting hard, when you start, you know, coming up with a fine regime. Finding a company for storing the wrong stuff, that's easy. Finding a company when, you know, a malicious attacker or groups of attackers have managed to do something to the data that they're allowed to store, that's when it gets a bit more complicated, in my view, at least. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I agree. I actually don't know for certain that Optus actually deserves to be fined in this case. So I can construct a scenario in my head where Optus actually has really good cybersecurity practices. They've got a whole lot of procedures that work, and they've just had one total clanger for some reason that is outside of their normal procedures.
And I actually said something like I had someone in my Twitter DMs last night asking me when the CEO of Optus is going to resign. I'm like, cool, you jets. We don't even know what happened, right? Like, obviously it was very easy to get that data out, but we don't know under what circumstances that API wound up being exposed. We just don't know.
Yeah, so that one thing I really would like to see, and that I've not heard, is talk about a report into the, you know, the reasons why. I think it'd be this is the sort of incident where it'd be good to have an investigation that finds out exactly what happened, what the root cause was, how it could be mitigated in a way that doesn't impose legal consequences for Optus. The kind of air crash investigation type
style. Yeah, something like the cyber security or cyber incident review board that they've set up in the United States.
Yeah, and that way you would also find out if Optus's practices were good or if they were bad. I think that provides an incentive for other companies to have a good look at what they're doing and see how they measure up. Yeah, that's something that hasn't been mentioned, but I think that's for a breach that has had such a high profile, I think this is the sort of thing that's worth doing.
Yeah, no, I agree. Unfortunately, the legislation would have had to have been in place before the breach, right?
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't exist.
I don't know that we're going to get much insight on this one, but it's certainly an interesting idea. And I think, you know, the United States is a little bit more restricted in terms of mandating that sort of stuff because freedoms. Whereas in Australia, it would be, you would think, a lot easier to pass a law that says, no, you have to submit to a full inspection of your stuff in the wake of an incident like this, in the wake of a nationally significant incident.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it just makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Now, we've got a write-up you've done here in response to something our good friend Kim Zetter has written in the Zero Day blog. She's got a blog post up that says she doesn't think the Viasat hack was, that it didn't have impact. Thus, it's being, you know, she sort of implies that it's being given too much significance in the sort of cyber world. You've written a response to that that respectfully disagrees. And it's perhaps not surprising that I'm aligned with your view on this. Like, this all happened because Viktor Zora, who is a senior Ukrainian cybersecurity official, originally said some months ago that the Viasat hack had a big impact on the ability of Ukrainian forces to communicate. But in a subsequent interview with Kim Zetter has said, oh no, you know, I misspoke. It didn't have any impact at all. But I guess what you argue here, and again, I agree, is that even if there was no direct impact, they were able to knock out a fundamental pillar of you know, communications availability to Ukrainian forces, and that makes this is still a very, very significant incident.
Yeah, in the piece, I kind of make an analogy to the nuclear triad. You know, we've got intercontinental ballistic missiles, strategic bombers, and submarines, and you'd never say that knocking out one of those arms was insignificant. Even if you've got backups. And in the military context, if you're in the field, you've only really got three options. They're kind of like radios, mobile phones, or satellites. And losing any one of those, I think, is very significant because it makes you vulnerable. And each of those also has particular characteristics that are somewhat unique. Like a mobile phone is not as useful as a radio in some respects. And also,
radio is one to many, right? Which is, I'm guessing something you're going to want in a lot of those scenarios.
Yeah, and also satellites are useful for things like drones, which have subsequently become a huge part of the war, or at least some particular types of drones. So I think that there's just a whole lot of nuance. I think, to be fair to Kim, I'm not sure that she's advancing that, but she's reporting on Viktor Zora sort of trying to pull back. I just don't think it makes any sense, though. Like, knocking that out.
It doesn't make a difference. I think that, and that's the part where I sort of, you know, find myself really agreeing with you. Is it like it doesn't matter?
Yes.
If they were still able to do radio comms, and we know that Russia has used EW to jam radio comms in theater, right? So what does that leave them with? That leaves them with cell phones, maybe, and satellite, maybe. The fact that the satellite stuff was unavailable.
Yeah.
Is very significant, right? Because you're being put into a much more vulnerable position.
Yeah, that's right. And I also think potentially, like you can jam satellite, but I think the consequences are, I think for the Russians using a cyber operation.
It takes more than a couple of guys in an EW truck to do that, right?
Yeah, and either you take out the whole satellite or you've got very limited effects. So the cyber operation just leaves them able to both target it to where they want, which is all of Ukraine, plus spill over awkwardly for them, but also leaves the EW units freer to focus on the things that are left.
Yep. Now, look, the last thing I want to talk to you about this week from the newsletter, there's stuff that we've skipped, right? So you've got a piece in there about how Russia's GRU has been linked to some of these Russian hacktivists and stuff. So people could go read that in the newsletter if they wanted to. But one of the shorter pieces that you included in the newsletter, it's savage. It's absolutely savage, and I love it. But it's also a really – you make a really interesting point about – Huawei, right? So I'll just step back for a second and explain what you've written here. The German Federal Office for Information Security, which is the BSI, has issued a statement to the effect of, hey, maybe it'd be a good idea if we didn't use Kaspersky software anymore because Russia might use it to do bad stuff to our computers. Now, funnily enough, we've seen these sorts of statements from other governments, but years ago, right?
Yep.
For this reason, which is if the Russian state decides that it wants to use any and all means at its disposal to inflict harm upon its adversaries, it could leverage the access it has to networks through the Kaspersky install base to do a lot of damage. Now, what I find interesting here is that Germany is a country that is totally happy to roll with Huawei infrastructure as well, right? And by bringing that into it, you've sort of, I think, explained maybe for some people in a pretty stark way what the concerns around Huawei infrastructure are. So if we imagine that we're in a similar position vis-a-vis, you know, Russia, Ukraine, but it's China, Taiwan, you know, can we see the Chinese government pulling the lever to affect network availability in the case of a war? And it's impossible to say that they wouldn't. Right. And that just really just sums up and explains the whole concern around Huawei, which is less about code backdoors and more about the fact that you're giving a foreign government control of critical infrastructure. I just haven't seen it presented so tidily before, Tom. I thought this was really good.
Yeah. I was actually really happy when that came to me in the shower. I guess the piece is really about that situations change over time and that what maybe seems like an acceptable risk today is not an acceptable risk in 9 months' time. And I mean, it just struck me that the other people have warned about, like you said, warned about Kaspersky, like you said, years ago. And it's, what is it? It's the end of September and Russia invaded in, was it February? Like, why does it take you 9 months, 6 months to figure out that this is a risk? You need to be looking ahead to those risks, especially when you're buying a whole lot of hardware and putting it into perhaps the center of your mobile phone network. You can't wait until after the war has started and then go, ah, oh, having all this infrastructure we can't rip out quickly, that's maybe not such a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, as you write here, it looks like Germany is quite happy to assume that type of critical infrastructure risk, which is understandable, really, since German reliance on Nord Stream is really paying off. And that's the savage part that I mentioned. But this is, you know, ultimately, what is the difference between your core telco network and your core energy network, right? Really, when it comes to criticality, they're both really, really critical. And, you know, we're seeing what Germany's reliance on Russian gas, the situation that's put it in. And, you know, now here they are, a day late and a dollar short, warning about Kaspersky while still rolling Huawei kit into their telcos. Like, I think it just doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, it doesn't suggest that they're very forward thinking.
No, exactly. I think to argue that Huawei is okay, I think you have to say that, and I think for some countries it probably is okay. I don't know. But you have to say, look, the chances that China will ever want to pressure us in the case of war breaking out of Taiwan are close to zero. And the value that we get because their equipment is cheap outweighs that close to zero risk. I don't think Germany's in that situation because it's a key member of the EU. The EU is very, like, you know, it's a global, maybe it's not a powerhouse, but it's globally significant.
And well, I mean, if you look at it in terms of economic output and also military spend, no, I think you can say collectively the EU is basically a superpower. So I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, even though they're really sort of dysfunctional and don't tend to flex it much, they do have it.
Yeah, and I guess the invasion of Ukraine is a good example of where the EU has actually stepped up. And so if things ever came to blows over Taiwan, I think the EU would be significant. I think Germany is significant within the EU, and there's a pressure point that you're putting yourself under for no reason. Well, because you just want a bit of cheaper kit.
Yeah, because you want to save a few bucks, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, Tom, anyone who wants to go check out this week's edition of the newsletter can do so. You can head to risky.biz/subscribe for the Substack link. Great to chat to you as always, my friend, and look forward to the next one. Cheers.
Thanks, Pat. See ya.